I want to acknowledge as we go into the reading and the sermon that this is a difficult topic to hear about. The reading I'm going to share with you is one I thought a lot about, whether I should. It is a reading by a young poet, Gabriel Cortez. It's about actually a true situation of two people. And I think that sometimes we need to focus on the poignant to really see things in our society. So I want you just to know that I understand that the topic is difficult as we delve into it. It's called Locked In by Gabriel Cortez. There is a boy who's locked in a box for 23 hours a day, and for 178 days he's completely by himself. In a room so small, when he stretches his arms, he can almost touch both walls at the same time. In a room so small, it feels like the walls are closing in on him, mostly because they are, mostly because he's still growing. He's only 16 years old and already corroding between maximum security walls, cuffed wrists, and cracking voice. Prisoner identification number and learner's permit. Locked in a solitary confinement cell the size of a small parking spot but feels like the trunk of a car. Crushed beneath hundreds of hours of forced isolation, desperately searching for human contact, only to collide with the sterile walls of his shrinking cell. He isn't alone. Across the city, in a juvenile detention box, a young girl is trapped in a box for 23 hours a day. While most of her girlfriends worry about locking parents out of diaries and bedrooms, cell phones and Instagram accounts, she's locked in to a 6 by 8 foot cell, smothered between walls barely wide enough for her to breathe. She's been holding her breath for 254 consecutive days now, and it's beginning to get to her head. When she's awake, black spotted hallucinations haunt her vision like mascara clumped thick in the corners of her eyes. And when they're closed, she drowns in the muffled screams of others, suffocating youth pounding on her walls, begging for someone to listen. Will it be any surprise when she finally starts screaming back, when he finally cracks his skull like a sledgehammer against the concrete wall of his cell, when she slits wrists to resist a solitary existence, craving trap doors, underground tunnels, fire escapes through skin and cell walls smeared in their own blood. Corrections officers will call this attempted suicide. I call it survival, a last desperate attempt to escape their shrinking cell. Every day, teens across America sacrifice their bodies to avoid the violence of forced isolation. Somewhere in this country, a young boy chews his wrist to the bone. A young woman forces a battery inside herself. A teen knots a makeshift noose around her neck and ties it to whatever will hoist them from this hole. Self-harming for the promise of human touch, even if only through coroner's gloves. Suicide is more common and solitary than any other part of prison, and we still do it, send our children to the box for talking back, for horsing around. Many aren't even convicted of a crime in the first place, guilty of simply not being able to afford bail. This isn't discipline. This is human experimentation, and we already know the results. How many isolated youth will emerge missing pieces of themselves? How many will return to jail like a child to an abusive parent? And how many youth will make caskets of their solitary confinement cell? A boy and a girl are locked in a box. They're only 16 years old and still growing. But what room is there for growth in a cell with barely enough room to stand? What room is there for therapy and rehabilitation when trauma is promised 23 hours a day? Solitary isn't punishment, it's torture. Drawn and quartered with no horses, waterboarding whole bodies buried beneath brick and mortar. Extraordinary rendition. Every isolation cell is a black site on American soil. Every isolation cell, an Iron Maiden, closing around hundreds of youth each year. May each youth's solitary confinement cell swing open so we can treat the youth inside and one day free the youth inside. Inside, a boy and a girl are slowly falling apart with our hands on the doors, and all they can do is wait. The poem I shared with you this morning by Gabriel Cortez is, as I mentioned, based on the true story of two individuals. They're named Trey Bundy and Daffodil Alton. I say their names to bring them present here. It's hard to hear. The hymn we just sang asks a powerful and a really tough question. Do we hear? And I think the answer to that question, for the most part, is no, we don't hear. We certainly don't hear much about what is going on in our prisons. It's not easy for news to get out of prison or for us to get inside. We're pretty much isolated from those who are in prison. Truth be told, most of us probably don't care to hear that much about what's going on in prison. We may feel that those who are in there got what they deserve. It has taken years now for our country to come around to looking at the travesty that long mandatory sentences for nonviolent cases, particularly drug cases, has caused, and especially in communities of color. Who are these people in jail? Well, you know, about 25% of our population is black or Hispanic, but about 60% of the population in prison is. And in the U.S. today, we have more than 70,000 juveniles locked in our jails. We think of ourselves as the land of the free, but you know that we have four times as many jails as Russia does. No other society in the history of the world has imprisoned such a large percentage of its population. It's only now, with the impact of movements like Black Lives Matter and books like the one many of us read together, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, and probably even more importantly for some, the recognition of the astronomical costs of having the highest rate of incarceration in the world, only now are those things getting changes started. We're beginning to address some of the crazy sentences people received for nonviolent drug offenses, and we're starting to change our mandatory sentencing laws. And thankfully, the spotlight is on this issue, and our ears are more open, and we're hearing about it. But there is a place where it's much harder for the light to shine in and illuminate the problem. A place from where we don't hear very much at all. The Platt Place is inside the prisons. Now, I'm not talking about looking at the number of years one might be serving in jail, but rather what's happening day after day to those who are incarcerated. I'm talking about how human beings that are inside our prisons are being treated. As a people who claim to affirm the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and I didn't read anywhere where there was an exception for prisoners, we need to open our eyes to see and our ears to hear what's going on inside our prisons. In so many ways, you know, as a society, we've been short-sighted on the effect of what we do or what we don't do with those incarcerated. You know, we understand prison as punishment, but we fail to remember how important the rehabilitation side of prison, or as they are called, houses of correction, is. The vast majority of prisoners are going, overwhelmingly vast majority, are going to get out of jail and try to reintegrate into society. And it's often not very successful. Many end up back in jail, and oh, you can say, see, They're just bad people. They never should have got out of jail in the first place. But I don't believe it's that simple. We need to look at the system in prison and what they did not do to rehabilitate the person so they could make a successful reentry into society. There are so many worthwhile programs that can be offered in jails to change people. Everything, some of you are involved in some of these, everything from training and alternatives to violence to GED programs, to skill programs, to full college educations. You know, for many years I served on a board, actually as president of an organization that did just that, offered college educations. And it was amazing how many obstacles the prison system put in our way of doing that work. We have to be more of attentive to what is going on or not going on inside our prisons. We in this faith tradition, I believe, are called to affirm that inherent worth and dignity of every person, and that includes those folks. Now look, there are lots of places where there are problems with how we treat those in jails. As a criminal defense lawyer, I know some of them firsthand. I represented prisoners who were denied medical treatment for serious conditions in jail, who suffered physical abuse in jail or prison, and perhaps worst of all, were kept in solitary confinement. And it's that practice that I want to focus on with you today. You know, now at first blush, maybe being in a private cell doesn't seem that bad. And in fact, the practice actually started as prison reform. In the 1700s, horrible, crowded, and often violent prison cells were the norm. And a group of reformers, which included Benjamin Franklin, argued in favor of solitary confinement, believing that prisoners would become more repentant if they could be left alone in silence. And the Quakers advanced that position, which resulted in the creation in 1790 of the Walnut Street Jail in Philadelphia, perhaps the first jail in the U.S. with solitary confinement cells. But what started with good intentions was soon recognized to have devastating effects. Charles Dickens, a half century later, visited the city's prisons and said, "The system here is rigid, strict, and hopeless. Solitary confinement, I believe, in its effects to be cruel and wrong." Yet the practice became ingrained in our system. And today there are estimated to be more than 80,000 individuals in solitary confinement in this country. It's not reserved for the most dangerous criminals, not even the most disruptive. And although it varies from state to state, the time one can be held in solitary confinement can be decades. There are proponents of solitary confinement who will argue it's necessary for the protection of other prisoners and guards. And I acknowledge that there may be times when very limited use of isolation and solitary confinement may be necessary. But let's keep in mind the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture declared that solitary confinement can constitute torture when it exceeds more than 15 days. Right now, the practice of this cruel treatment in much of this country is clearly excessive and unnecessary to accomplish any legitimate purpose. Moreover, the negative effects, both in the short and the long term, clearly outweigh any benefits. It was hard to listen to that poem by that young Latino man. And I don't want to inflict upon you a litany of horror stories. They are out there, of the things that happen in solitary confinement. But I want to point out that it causes physical and mental illness, frequently causes loss of vision, and it certainly exacerbates already existing medical and mental conditions. It causes the inability to focus attention on one hand, which means that individuals can't concentrate and they lose their memory. And it causes, on the other hand, the inability to shift attention, which leads to mental fixation, obsessive thought, and paranoia. It can ruin a person in a matter of weeks. In a short time, many become suicidal, self-mutilating, and even indifferent to soiling themselves. As you heard in that poem by Gabriel Cortez, it's not a pretty picture. Ask yourself how it would be to be locked in a box, generally about 6 feet by 8 feet, where you can't see or hear anyone for 23 hours a day. What would it do to your body? What would it do to your mind? What would it do to your soul? When I was practicing law many years ago, I represented a young, rather feminine acting man who was going to jail. Frankly, men like him have a tough time in the general population of jails, and he was scared of being attacked and raped. So for his safety, he was held in isolation. 2 weeks later, we had a hearing, and he was brought back to court. I was shocked by his mental state. He begged me to do whatever I could to get the prison to allow him to be held with the general population. He said he would much rather be raped than be held without human contact. It really drove the point home for me. I don't know about you, but I don't think I could withstand solitary confinement even for a few days. So back to that question we started with, do you hear? And if you hear, maybe you're thinking about what you can do. Well, there are campaigns at a national level and throughout this country to eliminate and restrict the practice. Our own UU Mass Action, which many of you know, Laura Wagner is in charge of now, has a group that's involved with this issue. There are groups sponsoring events regularly. They're often on the 23rd of the month. Why? Because it's a reminder of the 23 hours a day that individuals live in solitary confinement. You can keep yourself informed. You can become involved with them. Right here in Massachusetts, right now, there's opportunities to be involved. Now, I want to be clear. Massachusetts, through some court orders, has reformed some solitary confinement practices. And in 2009, Massachusetts banned punitive solitary confinement in juvenile facilities. And I want to understand that's in juvenile facilities. That doesn't mean young youth who end up in adult facilities. But there are still many in this state held for 23 hours a day in solitary confinement for long periods of time without appropriate review of the necessity of that, in regular review of the necessity for that treatment. And I know from my own experience representing young defendants that it's really not uncommon that you know, too mouthy youth who's landed himself now in adult prison for the first time and is being tough finds him or herself experiencing the inhuman treatment of solitary confinement. You know, astonishingly, in Massachusetts, you can still be placed in solitary confinement for just being disruptive, not dangerous behavior, for up to 10 years. There's a need for new legislation restricting and carefully regulating the use of this practice. And our own senator, Jamie Eldridge, has in fact filed such legislation. It's actually known as Senate Bill 1255, and along with its House counterpart, it's sitting right now in the Public Safety Committee, but it has not been reported out of the committee so it can be voted on. And as you probably know, many bills never see the light of day because they don't get reported out of a committee. And the deadline for reporting out bills for this year is March 16th, so this is a timely message. If you'd like to help, you can contact the committee chair's office or a committee member and encourage them to report out this bill, or you can call a representative. All the information is actually on a handout that's down on the social justice coffee table, and along with it, there's some information that if the bill should get reported out and you want to talk in favor of it, there's some talking points there. We're all called to put those principles that we affirm into action. We're all called to speak for those whose voices cannot be heard. You certainly cannot hear a voice from inside a solitary confinement cell. Our Jewish and Christian roots call us to do justice and build a land where we bind up the broken and treat the prisoner with dignity and respect, and where justice rolls down like a mighty stream. I hope you don't take despair from this sermon. The river is flowing, the tide is moving in the right direction. This sermon is an invitation to be part of building a land where we truly have compassion and treat other fellow human beings who, yes, are in prison and who, yes, have done wrong, with at least the most basic recognition of their inherent worth and dignity. May the love which overcomes all differences, which heals all wounds, which puts to flight all fears, which reconciles all who are separated, be in us and among us, now and always. Amen.